Good morning. My name is Kim Dvorak. That's D-V-O-R-C-H-A-K. My attorney registration number is 26795. I represent the appellate in this case, Michael Tate. Michael Tate was a 16-year-old juvenile who was prosecuted as an adult under the direct file statute. He was convicted of first-degree murder under a felony murder theory, with a specific finding that he did not cause death or serious bodily injury to the victim, Stephen Fitzgerald, and he was sentenced to a mandatory term of life without the possibility of parole. I want to thank the court for deferring argument on the sentencing issues until the United States Supreme Court issues its decisions in the Jackson and Miller cases regarding the constitutionality of life without parole for juveniles. That decision is expected by the end of the court's term this month. Today, I would like to focus my argument on two of the issues in the opening brief, the first being the constitutionality of prosecuting Michael Tate under the direct file statute, and the second, the abuse of discretion by the trial court in denying Michael Tate's challenges for cause in jury selection. As I said, Michael Tate was a juvenile at the time of the incidents in this case. The district attorney's office made a decision to directly file the case in adult criminal court under the direct file statute. That was a discretionary choice made by the district attorney's office. It was not mandatory. The case could have equally proceeded in the juvenile court system. That decision deprived Michael Tate of fundamental protections under the Colorado Children's Code. Most notably in this case, the protections of 19-2702 for mentally ill children, which require a suspension in proceedings when a child is mentally ill in the juvenile court and the case is transferred to probate, as well as juvenile sentencing provisions. The primary purpose of the direct file statute is to expose children to adult sentencing provisions. The direct file statute, as much as anything else, is a sentencing enhancement statute that violates the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial and the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution. I've made additional claims that the statute also violates equal protection and separation of powers, but I understand that people are arguing those claims are not preserved.
Do you agree that they were not?
I've argued that they were inferred, but I agree that they are not explicitly stated as such. I think there are, it could be inferred, particularly with respect to the extreme differences in sentencing. And I think that's what's so critical here, is that had the case proceeded in the juvenile court system, at most, Michael Tate was facing 3 to 7 years for first-degree murder in the Division of Youth Corrections. But the mere decision to file the case in adult criminal court resulted in an extreme disparity, mandatory life without parole. There's no due process from charging to sentencing in this case. There were findings of fact inherent in the prosecutor's decision to direct file this case, but those findings and that decision was never subject to review by judge, never subject to review by jury.
But why are you aware of any cases that have adopted your Apprendi argument and used Apprendi to overrule a prosecutor's charging decision?
I'm not aware of cases that have adopted the Apprendi argument, although other states have adopted a due process argument. The Mohi case out of Utah, state of Robert McL out of, I believe it's Virginia. Other states have argued that there is a fundamental denial of due process when the mere charging decision subjects a child to adult penalties.
But that's the issue you didn't preserve. What you're arguing here is Apprendi.
Well, defense counsel argued below was Apprendi. Right. And they also did cite the due process clause in their argument. They did cite the differences in sentencing, and they did argue that that was based on a decision made by a prosecutor.
So let me make my question more narrow then. Okay. Are you aware of any cases that have applied a strict Blakely Apprendi analysis to overcome a prosecutor's charging decision?
No.
Thank you.
Sure. Also, under 19-2702, we have cited the Colorado Supreme Court case of Briones. That statute is no long, has since been repealed, but under Briones, a juvenile court judge does not have the discretion to transfer a mentally ill child to adult criminal court under 19-2702. Yet, under the direct file statute, a prosecutor has more discretion to transfer a child to adult criminal court.
Why is that a problem?
Because there is no review. There's no ability to challenge the evidence that's being presented. I think it's striking that there is more restriction on the judge's ability to transfer a child to the adult court than on the prosecutor's decision.
So the legislature does not have it. The legislature violates the Constitution when it establishes that framework. Is that what you're arguing?
I'm arguing that the direct file statute, as it was in existence at the time, yes, did violate the Constitution. Nowhere else in our adult or juvenile system of justice can a party to a case make a decision of such magnitude that has such consequences without ceremony. It doesn't exist in any other place in our juvenile or adult
system. What limits are there on the prosecutor's filing decision generally? Are there any?
They have broad discretion to choose the charges in which they're going to file. That is the prosecutor's traditional discretion, is to elect which charges to file.
And has that been reviewable in any sense?
It's reviewable by jury. It's reviewable by preliminary hearing when it comes to the case. But here, a prosecutor's choice of court, a prosecutor's choice of forum, is completely unreviewable by judge or jury under the direct file statute.
Wouldn't analysis apply if a prosecutor chose to file a felony charge, which would be prosecuted in district court, versus a misdemeanor charge, it would be prosecuted in county court?
True, except the difference is that if the adult charged with a felony is ultimately convicted of a misdemeanor, they're in no different position than had they been charged with that misdemeanor in the first place.
That assumes that there's...
True, but whether the adult is even convicted of a felony, they're in the same position. There's only one court that adult can be prosecuted in. Here we have concurrent jurisdiction between two courts where there is equal jurisdiction over the same offense. The difference is in sentencing. And so...
Isn't the difference in the file statute?
It does. It does divest, which I have argued is unconstitutional, because it is a sentencing enhancement. I think that's why Apprendi is relevant, because it is a sentencing enhancement. It is a decision that subjects the juvenile to enhanced sentencing penalties. In this case, mandatory life without parole.
Whenever a prosecutor elects a charge that has a mandatory life sentence, isn't the same conclusion true?
No, well, the difference is the prosecutor doesn't have to make that choice. The prosecutor could make the choice to leave the case in juvenile court, and this child is not subject to a mandatory life sentence. So you have two similarly situated youth, one who could remain in the juvenile system, one who could remain in the adult system. They could be equally convicted of first-degree murder. One is getting 7 years in the Division of Youth Corrections. One is mandatory life without parole.
Conceptually, argument, how is that different from two identical defendants, one of whom the prosecutor chooses to charge second-degree murder, no mandatory life sentence, the other one the prosecutor chooses to charge first-degree murder, mandatory life sentence? So they are other in all respects equal, except by virtue of the prosecutor's decision, one is now exposed to life without parole. How is that? Why does your scenario raise a Blakely Apprendi issue, but the scenario I gave you doesn't?
Because it's a choice of court that fundamentally changes the sentencing structure. There is a choice made that's inherently greater than the choice of the charge.
Well, the discrepancy or consequence of choice may be greater. Why is one process subject to Apprendi Blakely scrutiny, but the other isn't?
I'm talking about two children convicted of the same exact offense. So you have first-degree murder in one court, first-degree murder in another court, with grave disparity in sentencing. Thank you. I'd like to turn now to the challenges for cause in this case. I would note that I think by and large the trial court conducted this three-week trial in a very fair and balanced way, which makes the denial of the challenges for cause all the more striking. I'd like to speak specifically with respect to jurors B and juror S. Juror B came to the table with a bias against the insanity defense, saying that it was just a way to get out of something you did. When the prosecutor asked if that juror was willing to listen to the law and apply the facts, the juror repeated, "I think it's a cop-out. I just don't buy it. I've held this opinion for quite some time." The prosecutor tried a second time to rehabilitate the juror, asking generally, "Can you apply the law to the facts?" Not with respect to insanity, but generally, can you apply the law to the facts? The juror replied, "Yeah, I could follow whatever you tell me to follow. It's just, like I said, I just find it a cop-out." Similarly, with respect to juror S.
Let's stay with juror B for a minute. I mean, didn't the trial court make a specific credibility finding when he said, "I think he did testify, he could follow the law, and I believed him"?
The court did say that, but I don't think that there's evidence in the record to support that.
I think we're bound by an express credibility, where there's an express credibility finding following inconsistent voir dire answers. You don't think we're bound by that?
Not in the face of repeated statements and clear expressions of bias. And I think that's what's striking in the jury selection here, is we have jurors who are making clear, repeated expressions of bias against the insanity defense. They are paying cursory lip service to a generalized application or a generalized ability to apply the law and the facts, but they are not disavowing, and I'm not saying there's a duty to disavow, but there is simply no basis in the record for the court's finding that I believed him the first time. And I think that's what's striking, is once a jury has stated over and over again, similarly with respect to juror S, who came off saying, "I don't believe in that defense. That's the way I felt my whole life." When the prosecutor tried to rehabilitate juror S said in his mind he could not set aside what would happen to a person at the end of the trial. Juror S said it was akin to not believing in the death penalty, that in that instance, he felt a juror essentially should not sit, that his bias was akin to not believing in the death penalty because he didn't believe in the procedures following an insanity finding. Again, he made a statement of, "I'm sure I could follow a general question of application of law to facts," but never made a specific finding with respect to the insanity defense. And so that is where I think the trial court abused its discretion. The trial court, who again was very fair throughout this trial, aside from the issues I've raised on appeal, has made very cursory statements. I believe the juror, with respect to juror number B, that they could follow the law, but there's simply nothing in the record to support it. Even after the prosecutor had tried to rehabilitate the jurors, there was again repeated statements and clear expressions of bias. So I see I'm close to the end here. I'll reserve the last minute for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Susan Friedman. I represent the people in this matter. My bar number is 34450. I think I will start briefly with the juror credibility issue. Something that struck me just right at the end was the comment about the court making just cursory findings. And I'd like to point out that the court and counsel individually questioned 39 jurors. This was so there was not opportunity to go into a long, detailed discussion of each juror. They were actually very surprised at how many people in the questionnaires had expressed concerns about the insanity defense, and so they had to individually question each one. So the court is also assessing these folks in the context of talking to 39 other people who had similar concerns.
A comment on counsel's argument that while there is a general statement about a willingness to follow the law, there is never an indication by either jurors B or S that specifically they could put aside this stated bias with respect to the insanity defense.
Well, I don't think that's required, but I do think, I mean, I think that's implied by saying, notwithstanding what you've said here today about how you feel, could you, if the judge told you that this is what you are supposed to do, could you follow these instructions? Implicit in the answer, yes, is that the person would not rely on their own bias, that they would follow the instructions instead. I mean, a lot of the questions were sort of given to these jurors in a vacuum, and they had no idea how the process worked. Juror S in particular was very concerned with what happens afterward. And all of his answers changed as soon as the trial court set him straight on what a juror, that the jurors have no responsibility in that, and that's not their part of their consideration. And his answers changed. With juror B, there were similar, I mean, if you look at juror B, most of the objectionable statements came from defense counsel's mouth in the form of a leading question. So we just have a yeah. And that is not as compelling to me as when a juror expresses a genuine doubt about following the law, not about the abstract concept of an insanity defense, when they have no idea what's required to prove it or what kind of evidence they're going to see. You know, some of the jurors were concerned about drug use or sudden insanity out of the blue where the person had no mental health history, and of course that has nothing to do with what the case would be. So they were answering to some extent in a vacuum. I think this court also does defer to an express credibility finding unless there's no support whatsoever in the record. And I don't think we can say that based on a cold record that the jurors' answers were just mere lip service. I think that is for the trial court to decide, and unless it's squarely contradicted by the record, that is, this court is bound by that. Addressing the direct file claim, I did not address in my brief the Apprendi-Blakely claim. It wasn't my understanding that was being argued. But my position is that the direct file statute is not a sentencing statute. It doesn't require findings of fact that operate to increase the presumptive range of a sentence. The presumptive range for first-degree murder is life without parole. For a juvenile in juvenile court, you have 3 to 7 years. So nothing that the prosecutor does or finds or decides alters those ranges set by the legislature. Apprendi and Blakely are concerned with findings not made by a jury that place the sentence outside of the presumptive range. So that's just not an issue here.
Has the defendant preserved the due process argument in your view?
That's a good question. I think there was a due process argument made with respect to not having the ability to present evidence of mental illness before the charging decision, but it wasn't made within the context of saying that the direct file statute as written, the fact that first-degree murder is an enumerated crime which does not require a transfer hearing and does not require sort of a pretrial notice and discussion with the defense about possible mental illness, they didn't argue that violated due process. They did argue that they should have had an opportunity to proceed under the Children's Code. But that's, of course, what the direct file statute is for. It's an exception to the applicability of the Children's Code. So the legislature has said for this offense, it's presumptively available to be filed as an adult. if you're over 16. And the fact that there is also an option to go in juvenile court doesn't make it violate due process, that that procedure is then different in juvenile court. I definitely do not believe that the equal protection claim was preserved, and I also think the law is very clear that the choice of the forum in this case that results from the charging decision is not distinguishable from the charging decision itself. So as you were saying, with deciding to charge second degree as opposed to first degree, that affects the sentence certainly, but it isn't a sentencing decision, it's a charging decision, and that's been upheld for hundreds of years. In choosing the forum, there's no reason to distinguish it here. It's still based on which offenses. Only certain offenses are eligible for direct file, and that's something the legislature has decided, and they've taken that discretion away from the court and allowed it only in the case of lesser felonies. So, as I said before, it's almost a presumptive permission to direct file for a kid over 16 who's accused of a class one felony. Another example of the prosecutor's discretion in that regard would be the decision to offer a deferred. That has a dramatic consequence. You can avoid a conviction altogether, but there's no review of that. There's no way to appeal the prosecutor's decision not to offer a deferred judgment to someone. So,
but the person has the option to decline on a deferred prosecution.
They do not have the option to get that opportunity, which is sort of the argument here that she should have had the option to lobby for or argue for application of the Children's Code. And so in the deferred judgment context, the defendant can't make the prosecutor offer a deferred. That discretion is left with them.
Nor can the prosecutor make the defendant accept the deferred, and here the prosecutor can make the defendant accept the direct file.
Sure, I mean, to the extent that there's no acceptance in being criminally charged. When a disposition is offered, yeah, the defendant would have the option. So that's a difference. But I think the law is very clear with respect to the direct file statute that it is constitutional. There is not a problem with the prosecutor's discretion. It's just like charging discretion. And I have heard nothing to explain why the legislature's choice in drafting the direct file statute in this way violates the Constitution. If there are no further questions, I would ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Just briefly on the juror bias issue, I would rely on the court's review of the transcripts. Even after the jurors discussed, said they could follow the law, there were again clear expressions of bias. So I would just ask the court to carefully review the full transcript of each individual juror challenged for cause. With respect to the direct file claim, I just want to clarify there were two separate motions filed. There was a motion invoking the Children's Code, and that was with respect to the 192702 claim, arguing that because Michael Tate was mentally ill, 192702 should be applied to suspend proceedings. That was the Children's Code motion. There was a separate motion challenging the direct file statute itself. It begins on page 163 in the record. And that is where counsel has cited the Due Process Clause and the Sixth Amendment right to a trial, and cited that a single entity of the state without any oversight is making a decision subjecting a 16-year-old child to life without parole. So, thank you very much.
This case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.